Hello and welcome to the Scholars Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what dictators, CEOs, and other political leaders have in common. We'll explore some of their strategies for getting and keeping power. Then, some scholars say deception is a normal part of everyday life, even biological. Others say there's a cost to our lies, even the white ones. We'll explore the truth about lying. Is there a universal formula for getting and keeping power? Our next guest says there is, and it often involves what he calls bad behavior. Alistair Smith is professor of politics at NYU, New York University, and the co-author of The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Welcome, Alistair Smith.
I'm glad I could be with you.
You start by examining the city of Bell. Remind us of what happened in Bell and how this plays into your argument about bad behavior being good politics.
We regard all leaders, whether they're of corporations, sports federations, dictatorships, or democracy, as all having some basic desire, and that's sustained power. And this would be exactly the same with the leaders in Bell. And this was, I'm sure this hit the news in L.A., and it even made it over to New York in terms of the newspaper, that the leadership there, the Rizzo, had set up this beautiful system where he got paid around, I think it was $700,000 salary. So he was massively more paid than virtually every other elected public official in the country. And he managed to do this because he engineered a system where he could be beholden to very few people to stay in power.
You're talking about the city manager.
Absolutely. And this is the goal that all leaders, this is one of the sort of five basic principles that leaders want to have of coming to power, is they want to be beholden to very small numbers of people. They don't want to rely on many people to stay in power. And so he organized this very tiny sort of election to switch the charter of the city so it wasn't governed by the rest of the city, state of California. And this small rule change, which was sort of an innocuous, boring, bureaucratic rule, so very few people turned up, meant that with a few hundred votes, he could actually assemble a city council that would vote through all the reforms he wanted. So his salary went up from, I think, around $150,000 to 10 years later being $700,000 plus. So he managed to do this because he could rely on very few people. And then the people on the town council that got elected with these very small numbers of voters, several hundred voters were all he needed really to keep most of these people in, they managed to vote themselves enormous salaries via special enterprise zones and special committees. That's how they got rich.
You talked about how the city then charged some 50% more for property taxes, and they just engineered this entire system of politics that resembles often what you say are dictatorship politics.
Absolutely. So one of the other fundamental rules you want to do is tax as heavily as you possibly can. Tax as heavily as the economy will bear, and the people and your supporters will pay. Well, you know, Rizzo's now got this system where he's not actually beholden to very many people. Not many people pay attention to this small-scale town politics, changing the rules and such like. And most of the council members don't require that many votes, several hundred votes, to become a member of this committee. And so what they did was they taxed very heavily, much higher taxes than richer, wealthier neighbors that surrounded them. They brought all this money in, and they distributed it out to themselves and to favored people, but they didn't generate good public policy for the people. These are the rules. You want to reward those who are keeping you in power.
Why a small group to be beholden to? Why is that helping to keep certain people in power?
Leaders always, the best way to survive as a political leader is to reduce the number of people you need to stay in power. So this would be disenfranchising people in the electoral system is a perfect way to stay in power. That way you need the support of fewer people. So in the U.S., we see the Electoral College. That means the president only needs to win about 35 million votes to win the presidency. You typically get much more than that, but you don't need to win as many because you don't have to win half the support of half of the voters, which is what we typically think, but that's not what you need to do to actually win. So all leaders want to change the rules to get the group as small as possible. And the great thing is, if you don't have many people to reward, you can give each of them, and you, so just think of it in a very simple way. You have a pot of money. You don't have many people. They can each have a very large, each person's share of the pot of money is very large. That doesn't work once you get up into huge numbers because each person's share becomes very small. And so leaders, when they're beholden to a lot of people, they have to start producing good public policy, which is much harder to do, and it's easier for rivals to claim they can do a better job.
Now, one of the things that struck me in this book, it's actually in the very first chapter, you talk about politics not being complex, but then you say leaders are not monolithic, and it's silly to think that they are in control of their jurisdictions, whether they're countries or companies. And you take a look back at old France. What can we learn from old France, and how does this all come together?
Well, this is the great thing. So we tend to think of, you know, these regimes, we call them absolute monarchs when we think of sort of Louis XIV. He's an absolute monarch. You know, everything he said was law. Well, everything he said was law because the people that were enforcing the system agreed with him, everything that he said being law, because he was paying them a lot. So no leader stays in power by themselves. So whether we want to think of it as a corporation, or we want to think of it as a sports federation, or we want to think of it as a democracy, you have to have supporters to keep you in there to make the rules. So everybody relies upon keeping these supporters happy. So that's the simple objective of political leaders, is to keep these people happy to stay in power. The difference between all the different, how the different systems function, is the number of people that you have to keep happy.
Right. And so, and you talk about these three groups of peoples, you call them dimensions. Mm-hmm. You say they're consistent across governments, whether democracies or dictatorships. Explain these through three groups of people, the nominal, real, selectorate, and the winning coalition. And how do we see them in both dictatorships and in democracies?
Yep. So when we tend to think about political organizations, we tend to think democracy and non-democracy, or a junta or a dictatorship. But what we don't realize is that there's enormous variation within those categories. So we want to, instead of thinking about, that all democracies are the same and all autocracies are the same and all hunters are the same, we want to think about them on a continuum of scales. So the simplest scale is the winning coalition. How many supporters does a leader need? So we can think, here we've done some expert surveys asking sort of country experts, how many people does this leader really need? So it could be from a few hundred in some of the most autocratic systems like North Korea, up to 35 million people in the United States to be president. So that can vary enormously. Then we want to think about, who really has some say. So in a democracy, that tends to be all adults. Or all adult citizens, I should say. So in the U.S., there's about 160 million registered voters. So that's the selectorate, and that's the people who get the choice. In other systems, it could be much lower. If we were in a monarchy, then we'd only be really worrying about aristocrats. If we were in a junta, we'd be worrying about the senior generals. But that's, so we want to worry about how many people we have to pick to be supporters, and how big a pool can we draw supporters from.
So what you're saying is the broader the selectorate, the more likely you'll have a system that is more democratic in nature and more perhaps egalitarian?
This is a classic mistake we want to think of. So you use the term selectorate there. So this is the pool of people who have some nominal say. So this would be an electorate. And in the U.S. system where we have fixed electoral rules, you're absolutely right that the more people we bring into the electorate, the more the coalition of supporters of political leader needs, because we actually obey the electoral rules. But actually, this is one of the points we make in the book, is that rigged elections are sort of a terrible thing for the people. So in those kind of systems, what we do is we allow everyone to vote, but the votes really don't count. We know that that's not really the important point. It actually depends upon not who votes, but who counts. And it turns out the counters are the important people in an electoral system, in a corrupt electoral system. And one of the beautiful things about, and it's exactly the opposite to what you just said, is by making the electorate larger, we make the society more equal. We do exactly the opposite. What we do is we make the leader could still be beholden to a small number of people, but the corrupt electoral system allows the leader to find lots and lots of replacements. There's nothing special about people in positions of power in a democracy. They can be replaced by anybody. You can always rig another election to get somebody out of the parliament and bring back another crony. So it's not the selectorate we should worry about. It's how many people matter?
You know, you wrote about once these coalitions are put together by leaders in order to put them in power, that it often changes once they reach power. You use the example of Fidel Castro. What happened with Fidel Castro?
This is a classic case that all leaders face, is when you come to power, you need the people who are in positions of authority now. For example, people in control of the army, people in charge of the police, to support you coming to power, or voters of the current regime in a democracy to turn against the incumbent to bring you to power. So you're very constrained in who you can choose when you try to come to power. When you put your coalition of supporters together, you've got to, in some sense, include some of the old guys because you needed them to come to you so that you could kick the incumbent out. But once you get there, you've got the problem that, well, these people have already demonstrated they're not very loyal. They just helped you bring down the previous guy. So you should sit there and think, I would like to get my cronies in, the people who are really loyal to me, people who only have a standing in society because of me, who won't be good rivals. And so then what leaders like to do is try and weed out the people they suspect of being disloyal and replace them with people that they think will be loyal over the long term. And so we see lots of culling of people when they come in. So we can think of some other classic examples. So as you pointed out, Castro, he wiped out most of the cronies that fought alongside him in, you know, the rebel movements, very usual. People fighting, comrade in arms, they get into power. One guy comes in charge, all the other guys suddenly become traitors. Very familiar story. You could think of Adolf Hitler had, you know, the famous sort of Night of the Long Knives. The black shirts turned up and the SS turned up and took away all the brown shirts, his previous sort of paramilitary organization. Complete sort of culling overnight happened.
Do you see that much in democratic settings?
Yeah, well, we do, not to as great, we don't see the violence, obviously, we don't, George W. Bush came to power, you know, with Christian conservatives, you don't see him, you know, dropping factions of the, you don't see, you know, factions that he's no longer supporting their positions, we don't see them being knifed, but we do see that politicians come to power and they'll move their support base. So they won't adopt, so they come to power promising to do X, Y, and Z, and maybe they do X and Y. They don't do Z, so some of the people are going to want to move from them, and at the same time they'll be trying to attract supporters they think are going to be more likely to support them if they give them their policies. So we see this, politicians, as we all know, never completely honest about what they're going to do. They, once they get in, they'll shift who they support.
So in essence, you say these rulers come into power with coalitions, then they shake them up, replace them, then allocate money to keep their new coalition happy, but not too happy, and then give enough to the rest to keep them from revolting.
That's right. You've been reading the book very carefully. You sort of summarized the rules, right? You want to get in as small number of people as possible from a big pool. You want to tax very heavily, which is sort of the one thing we haven't talked a huge amount about. Then you pay off the coalition and then make sure you keep some money for yourself. Don't be too nice to the people. That's exactly what all good leaders who want to keep their job should do. And leaders get into trouble when they fail to follow these rules.
It's very Machiavellian, no?
Absolutely. And, you know, we've been accused of being very cynical, but cynical doesn't mean wrong. Cynical just means we believe it's both cynical and extremely accurate way that to describe how politics works. And it is a cynical Machiavellian approach, but, you know, we spend a large portion of the end of the book developing ideas of we tell you how the system works. So this is how you fix it. You can't fix a system unless you understand how it works. You don't take your car to a mechanic if the mechanic has no idea how a car runs. They can't make your car work better if they don't understand how it works. So we spend a lot of time developing these rules and explaining how the system works, and then we tell you how you're going to fix the system.
You say leaders support those who support them or who will keep them in power, but couldn't it be the reverse, that their concern for a certain ideology dictates the block?
We don't deny that ideology and culture have some, that they exist, but we just think they're very convenient labels. So we can identify by these labels who's going to be rewarded and who's going to be punished. So if we want to think about the contemporary debate, for example, in the U.S., we got the jobs bill. We can think of this as sort of a big ideological thing. Is it class warfare? Is it, you know, do we want to tax? Do we want tax and spend? Do we want to let free markets reign? We can think of a lot of ideological labels being used in this debate. But what it really comes down to is these labels are telling us who's going to win, who's going to profit under the scheme if a leader comes in, and who's going to suffer. So if let's take the extreme here. We've got, let's cut taxes. Well, who would benefit if we're going to cut taxes? Rich people are going to benefit if we cut taxes. Well, who tends to be rich? Republicans tend to be rich. They're going to like these policies. If we think about job creation, Obama keeps talking about, you know, he wants money for teachers and public service employees and construction workers. Well, who's going to benefit from those? Well, unions, teachers, construction workers tend to be Democrats. So he's basically talking about transferring. So we may think of these as ideology, but we're really just identifying groups that are going to be rewarded under different sets of policies.
It could be that they actually believe in these policies, and so do those other people. Perhaps people on one side really want to stay in power in order to make sure the system is more egalitarian.
This is always, of course, we don't get the opportunity to see people act outside of this chicken or egg thing. So we have to look for a few examples of where people switch policies. So let me give you two. Let me give you an example, an American example, and then I'll move to a more extreme example. So think of a famous American politician, Strom Thurmond. So Strom Thurmond was a huge segregationist. He was took positions that were highly racist right up until the Civil Rights Act came through, and suddenly he found out he had a constituency that was full of blacks. What did he do as soon as he had that? He completely switched the sets of policies he wanted. He went from this group should be disadvantaged to, oh, I have to rely upon a lot of this group now. I'm going to switch my policies. So here's a politician who knew what he needed to do and what he needed to do to stay in power shifted, so he changed policies. I can give you an even more extreme example, which is actually one of the few cases Bruce and I identified as a leader who's an individual who's ruled two countries at the same time. Lots of people do it like you're the queen of one country and therefore you're, you know, a ruler of an empire, but as actually two independent countries. So King Leopold of Belgium also ruled the Congo, but he ruled that as he set this up as a private company that went over and captured the Congo for himself. So when he was back at home, he believed in liberal ideas, unions, promoting working standards and healthcare for an education for the people. And in the Congo, he was a brutal killer of anyone who resisted him in any way that stopped him making money on rubber. So we have to ask ourselves, leaders are doing what gets them in power and wealth, they're not adopting the same ideological conditions under two different circumstances.
Is this really applicable in the general sense, or are you taking a single individual and trying to say that all leaders are like him because he's the one example we have where you see a double ideology?
No, I think that's not that. We see changes at all. So one of the descriptions we spend a lot of time talking about was a classic reformer, which was Jerry Rawlings in Ghana. So we spend a lot of time talking about JJ, he was known as, Junior Jesus. He was a bit of a charismatic character in Ghana. He came in, instituted a socialist revolution when he first came into power, and wanted to pay the army and promote socialist ideas and stamp out opposition to himself. This was right up until he ran out of money. And then we see him radically changing his policies, liberalizing, and he actually became the sort of poster boy for IMF reforms and then liberalizing democracy. But he didn't do this because he wanted to. He did this because he had to.
Is it that particular kinds of people pursue leadership?
We often get asked this. So people ask us, do you believe that all leaders are sort of nasty and brutish and self-interested? And the answer to that question is, well, first I scratched my head. I was like, all the words made sense, but put together, of course, they do. Yeah, what else could you possibly think? Is it possible that there are people who are less self-interested around the world? I suspect that might be true. We could vary on that degree. But the point is, those kind of people are not going to run for political office. So we might ask ourselves, political leaders, seizing power in a democracy involves taking hideously violent acts and brutal suppression of opposition and often killing people. People who aren't interested in coming to power and paying those costs aren't the kind of people who become leadership roles. So we shouldn't worry. So Within the set of leaders, though, I think it's incredibly clear that they're all self-interested louts.
So it is the kind of person that finds himself or herself pursuing a position of leadership.
I tend to think, not everybody wants to be the leader of a country. I personally think it would be, being a leader would be a horrible job. But the set of people that do, there's a lot of people who want to pursue power. There is no shortage of claimants to the throne, shall we say.
Is it possible for benevolent types, altruistic or symbiotic types, to be able to reach and keep leadership if, in fact, you are right about the process it takes to get into power and stay in power?
So you're maybe thinking, we have our Plato philosopher kings. Wouldn't this be perfect? Our benevolent dictator, he could just do the right thing.
I'm thinking also not necessarily benevolent dictator. I'm thinking Jimmy Carter. Obviously, he didn't stay in office. So he pursued power, but he didn't keep power. Could we have people who are actually truly concerned about the plight of people?
I think you can, but they can't always act upon that all the time. So the first thing is, even if you want to really help the people, you can't help the people unless you stay in power. So the first and foremost job you have to do, even if you want to, in some sense, spend all the discretion you have on helping the people, is stay in power. And staying in power relies on keeping your cronies happy. So in a democracy, that actually generally means doing things that are good for the public good, because you have to keep so many people happy in the first place. You may as well work towards the public good in some sense. In an autocracy, it's very hard to spend money helping the people if that takes money out the pocket of your cronies. So we could think of a classic example would be Julius Caesar, right? There's a lot of confusion about him. Everybody thinks he's this guy who wants to be king in Rome. The reality is he went around reforming the roads, laying out the city, getting the water working, organizing the calendar, tons of things. But he made a big mistake, was he also started canceling debts of the common people to promote the economy. Well, of course, he relied upon members of the Senate and powerful rich people who were owned this debt. They were very unhappy about this, and so they stabbed him down. So you can only be good if it comes out of your pocket, not out of your cronies' pockets.
You reminded me of this section of your book about infrastructure and education, and I was struck by the African leader, who said to the Rwandan president, don't build roads, because then those are more roads they can come and get you with. And the only roads to develop are the ones that help you get out when you need to.
Absolutely. This is, and he was quite ruthless in his pursuit of power and maintenance of power. He didn't give a damn about the people of Zaire. They lived miserable, miserable lives. So let me give you another example rather than just the roads, which he inherited like 70,000 miles of roads. And when he left, several decades later, it was only like 6,000 miles of roads left. He got rid of them, just let them decompose. But he actually decided he was going to run his copper mines that were down in the south of the country with hydroelectric power stations from the river right near where he controlled in the north. So he ran a power line, basically close to 1,000 miles across the country. And he actually went out of his way to bypass all the cities and towns on the way so that no one would have electrification. But he maintained the key thing was that since he then controlled the power supply, he could turn off the copper production. If anyone else tried to steal it and seize control and get the wealth from the copper mines, he could control that copper mine. So he was focusing on bringing the wealth to him.
And similar with education.
Absolutely. You want to educate people. If you're an autocrat, you want to educate people to the extent that they can do the jobs you need them to do. And so educating them more than that, giving people an advanced education, people learn how to organize against you. And we saw that leaders in Egypt, for example, got in trouble because they had a large number of educated and underemployed people who could organize protests against them. If you keep the people poor and ignorant and separated, very, very hard for them to organize against you.
Let's talk for a moment about the corporation, because you say these apply also to corporations.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And specifically with the same kinds of rules, but then also how corruption really helps. How does it help these leaders?
Well, so the reality is we think of the classic economic model is the company is out there maximizing profit. You know, they're not maximizing profit. They're not helping companies. Leaders want to stay at the top of their corporations, and so they have to keep the support of people. So who are the supporters in a publicly traded company? We'd like to think it's the shareholders, but you and I are all own some kind of share, and occasionally we get those proxy forms through the newspaper, through the mailbox, right? And what's the first thing we do with that? We look and, I don't understand what this is, and we throw it away. So most of the time, we have a nominal say. We have a vote, but our votes don't matter. Control of publicly traded corporation comes down to the board, a few senior management, and a few big institutional investors. So that's typically tens of people. It's rarely more than tens of people. And yet these can be huge multi-billion dollar organizations.
When we look at a system where there is considerable corruption, you say that if we do things like increase sentencing, look at legislative fixes, they're counterproductive in part because they give leverage to the powerful. Why do you say that?
Well, you know, we could just let's stay on the sort of business environment now. We just sort of said, you know, corporations are run with a relatively small group of supporters, and we want to know why people are on occupying Wall Street screaming about why Wall Street is so tone deaf to the plight of the people. It's because the leader's beholden to this small number of people, and how should they be rewarding them with big bloated consultancies and big private fees for running corporations, and executive salaries should be huge. So we get this kind of corruption. And so what we're seeing is we expect to see these big salaries. So, you know, the call at the moment for reform is let's outlaw these large salaries and everything. And this is a terrible thing to do because this is the basis of corruption. Would we sooner see things paid illegally rather than legally? If the basis of political power is rewarding a small number of people, it's always going to be involving large amounts of transfers of cash. So, you know, we see this in the Olympic Committee. We see huge bribes being paid for votes to locate the Olympics in a particular city. So outlawing things, ignoring the underlying political incentive, is always the wrong way to go. And I think you're pointing to the section of the book where we say, if you make a law against sort of taking bribes and bad behavior, all you really do is empower the person who gave out the bribe, but they now have evidence to keep people in line even more.
And so you say the incentive system itself should perhaps be changed.
Absolutely. There's no point changing a rule. So, you know, if you take a salary above $10 million, you've broken the law. Because then people are going to start trying to reward supporters through the back door, so long as leaders are beholden to a small number of people. So what you want to do is you've got to change the actual governance structure. So if we go to the sort of the Olympic Bribe Committee, which is something many people are familiar with, the Salt Lake City bribery, every year there's huge amounts of bribery, and I'm a huge soccer fan. FIFA's full of bribery about where they're going to locate the World Cup of soccer. Every year, it's going to be in Qatar. It's going to be terrible. But the reason is there's lots of bribery because so few people are involved in making that decision. All we have to do is to make those decisions get made better and outlaw corruption is simply have the decision depend upon more people.
How would that apply in governance?
In a corporation, we want to...
I meant in political governance.
Political governments, well, we want to make the President of the United States more accountable to the people. We should get rid of the Electoral College. The president would overnight have to appeal to twice the number of people he currently has to appeal to. So at the moment, you need to win half the seats in, you know, sort of half the states. We can win even less because some states are overrepresented in the Electoral College. So half the seats, so that's in half the you need half the votes in half the states, so that's 25% of the vote. If you had got rid of the Electoral College, all of a sudden you need 50% of the vote. So instantly you make the president work much harder. He's got to keep twice as many people happy as he was before. In Congress, you get the same thing, gerrymandering. So many districts are so highly gerrymandered where the politicians pick their voters rather than the voters pick their leader that you can control Congress. Very few of the seats are competitive.
Alistair Smith, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. The name of the book is The Dictator's Handbook, Why Bad Behavior is Almost Always Good Politics. Thank you so much.
That'd be my pleasure. Thank you.
When we come back, what is the truth about lying? Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Some scholars say that deception is ubiquitous and normal in all human interactions, that lying is useful and possibly even biological. Others suggest that there is a cost to lying, even for white lies. What is the truth about lying? We have three experts with us. Cicela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, Secrets on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, and A Strategy for Peace, Human Values and the Threat of War. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and Hidden Conversations, An Introduction to Communicative Psychoanalysis. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar's Circle. Two of you, you've argued that deception is essentially ubiquitous, possibly even natural, biological. Cicela Bach, you argue that while that may be so, it's rarely justifiable and has a cost. Maybe we should start by distinguishing the kinds of deception and lies and where they occur. Cicela Bach, what do we need to know to understand lying and deception?
There are so many different kinds that take place in so many different circumstances, but then there are some cases that come before the public that really reveal a great many of them. And I would say, for instance, President Clinton and all that was discussed about his deception and his various forms of lying and also probably his forms of self-deception, that was so interesting because people in the public had a chance to see a person saying one thing and then saying the opposite. We have Lance Armstrong, and he, to us scholars, I believe, perhaps I speak for all three of us, it's particularly interesting to hear his testimony about what went on, how ubiquitous it was indeed, how much he did, and how he regrets it, how he got into it. So I'm fascinated by that case.
And how he justified it as well.
How he justified it for a while.
David Livingston Smith.
There are a number of forms of deception, many of which we don't really tend to identify as deception. We call them tact, or when we deceive our children, we call it preserving the magic of childhood, and so on and so forth. So there are various descriptions that we use to soften the raw fact that we deceive one another a good deal of the time. A very important dimension here with regard to deception is, of course, the moral significance of deceptions. Deceptions are far more morally significant than others.
Such as?
Such as, well, the way you see this depends on the moral theory you're operating with, but of course, some deceptions are morally consequential, and those are not necessarily negatively morally consequential. So there are situations in which deception is morally obligatory. You know, it's something that we should do. We would be wrong if we were not lying and deceiving. And there are other situations in which deception is morally wrong, that it's destructive, it's hurtful, it's contrary to human flourishing.
Now, as I recall, one of you said that this is the paradoxical aspect of lying. Lies can damage, but so can truth. What do you think we need to know? Charles Ford?
Deception and self-deception are ubiquitous. To say that does not make it morally right, however. It's just merely a fact of life. And I should say not just of human life, but truly throughout the entire biological world. Now, again, in regards to whether it's right or wrong, that's an entirely different issue, and I can only speak from my own personal view, but that is that a deception that harms another person is morally wrong. And sometimes, I got this from Dr. Bach's writings, sometimes we lie supposedly to help another person, but what we're really doing is lying to kind of help ourselves so that we don't have to deal with the discomfort, such as a physician lying to a dying person. Is that really for the person who's dying who may actually wish the truth, or is it so that we don't feel so bad about it ourselves?
Cicely Bock, this is your bailiwick.
I certainly agree with Charles Ford that there is a lot of what we might call deception, though it could be a euphemism, going on even in the cellular world, so to speak, and certainly among animals. It's not the same as lying. Some people have argued that only human beings can really straight out lie. But then the question of lying to the dying, when I wrote my book, Lying, which actually came out in 1978, the first edition, it was common for doctors to lie, especially to dying patients and especially to those who had cancer. By now, and in part, maybe my book had something to do with it, American Medical Association has changed its rules, and it's very clear that people on the whole want to be told the truth. But then there is a way of telling the truth, and I think that is what Professor Smith was saying. Sometimes it can be very destructive to tell the truth in such a way, and doctors can do it. Oh, yes, you have cancer. Goodbye. I'm leaving now. That form of telling the truth is very destructive. That does not mean, though, that you have to lie. Instead, I argue in my book Secrets that there's a whole region of learning to understand people, learning how to speak to them, not lying, but at the same time caring about their response enough so that you don't tell the truth destructively.
I really scoured the literature to try to find research that spoke to perhaps there are certain realms where lying does not occur. From the other two scholars, it sounds like it really is ubiquitous throughout life. Is there something that I missed in the literature that shows there are certain areas of life where it doesn't occur?
Well, there certainly are areas where one can keep it to a minimum. And there, I think what Professor Smith mentioned, the questions of tact and magic of childhood, preserving that, etc. There are ways of speaking that I wouldn't call lying, actually, at all. For example, even, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Well, nobody expects you to tell about your recent medical problems. So I don't regard that as lying at all. Then I also think what Gandhi said was so important. He taught about and wrote about truthfulness and nonviolence. And he said that the way to start addressing those really is in one's personal life, to try to create regions with one's family, with one's friends, at one's work, where one really tries to cut down as much as possible on the various forms of deception.
We have this idea that this is ubiquitous not just in humanity, but in nature. Charles Ford, why is it in nature, and how useful is it, and does that mean that it has to be in humanity?
When we look at this from a biological perspective, essentially all animals, and there may be a few exceptions, but essentially all animals are either predators or prey. And therefore, the question becomes, how can you obtain a meal in order to live another day? Or how can you avoid being prey and therefore living another day? And so you have this continuous arms race between predator and prey of how can one outsmart the other in order to either get a meal or avoid being a meal. Now, to some extent, that happens with humans also, and very unfortunately, I would say, and perhaps more currently in our culture right now than when I was a child. There is an enormous amount of competition, and one of the ways that you can compete is, unfortunately, by deception. And that, again, I would emphasize, does not make it morally right, and does not rationalize it, but it is a fact that that is one way that you can get ahead. Now, if you're caught, of course, then you have lost all that advantage, you've lost all that power, and you may be shunned by others.
So it is an act of manipulation in both the animal kingdom and in human relations.
If I can step in here, and this is Cicely Bock again, to say it certainly is true, for instance, that birds send deceptive signals. There are all kinds of things happening in the animal kingdom of just that nature. But of course, birds cannot stop to think about what might happen to me as a person with a conscience if I lie, and if I lie a lot. And that is why it's so interesting among human beings that on the whole, the ones who have been caught, as Professor Ford mentioned, regret very much that they got into it in the first place. And there are so many examples of how people just sometimes slip into something, and then they feel they have to protect the original lie, and they go on, and all of a sudden they can't get out. And then, on the whole, they do regret it, if you ask them. Not everybody. There are some people who are totally callous.
That actually brings up something that David Livingston Smith has written about, which is the unconscious, conscious parts of the brain. Can you help us to understand this process?
There's a lot of hype about neuropsychology, but in fact, we don't have much of a clue of how neural processes result in mental processes or embodimental processes. But I don't think that's really what you're getting at. I think the issue here is how we represent the world to ourselves. And this really introduces a whole new dimension to this discussion. By and large, when we talk about lying and deception, we think of someone who knows, who is aware of what is true, and who intentionally misrepresents that truth to others for purposes of personal gain. But often it doesn't work that way. Often it's the case that we misrepresent the world to ourselves initially, and then broadcast that misrepresentation to others. As it happens, some of these misrepresentations to ourselves are self-serving. So we can, in this way, sort of be in bad faith in good faith. I think that's quite an important distinction between the sorts of deception that's consequent upon self-deception and the sort of deception which is intentional and strategic and calculated. And by the way, if we're looking at non-human organisms, it's not just animals. I mean, it's plants, it's even microorganisms that deceive. But of course, they don't deceive in this intentional fashion. Their deceptive properties are built into automatic behavioral routines or their morphology or so on and so forth.
Well, this brings up a couple of things that I'd like to go into. One, I believe, David Livingston Smith, this was also in your work, and this pertained to how people self-deceive in order to remain happy. I believe you called it to remain mentally healthy, while depressed people tended to be more accurate. It made me wonder about the definition of mental health.
A lot of this sort of language is normative, moralizing language dressed up as medical language. We have these ideals of how people should be, and we call those healthy. And we have ideas about how people shouldn't be, and we call them sick. Our notions of mental health, well, it's been shown that they correlate to a significant degree to levels of self-deception. There's optimal self-deception. The world is a rough place. We're all going to die. Everyone we love is going to die. A lot of the world lives in misery, and we buy our clothes from companies that employ virtual slave labor and so on. There's a lot that we close our eyes to in order to maintain a certain sort of mental equilibrium. We call that healthy.
Charles Ford, you've talked about these other aspects of self-deception, like false memory syndrome. What is that, and what are the consequences?
The false memory syndrome actually are memories that people have, I should say memories in quote, which have been suggested by other people, and then it becomes their belief. Many people are very suggestible, but all of us have this tendency to remember things differently each time we bring it back into consciousness. Now, when we sit down at the computer and we have a program such as Word and we type something in, and it'll ask us when we push save, do we want to save the original? Do we want it with the changes? Unfortunately, our memory doesn't allow us to save the original. It always goes back in with all of the changes that occurred according to whatever emotional state we were in at the time that we had the memory return. This sounds complex. It's actually relatively simple and was beautifully explicated by Elizabeth Loftus, and it's what I call the malleability of memory. It's one of the dangers of psychotherapy, where someone can suddenly have memories of things that never occurred. I wanted to go back, though, and respond to something that Dr. Bach had said, that people who lie and are caught are often very regretful that they had lied. I'm not sure that I would agree with that in toto, and certainly many of the people that I see are very regretful. Yes, they're regretful that they got caught, not necessarily that they lost.
Absolutely, and certainly that is what Lance Armstrong said first, absolutely. And then he wished he hadn't done all that he had done, but you're quite right. Getting caught is one of the things that is not anticipated often by people who lie a lot, and yet that is distressing in the extreme.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about deception. We have three experts with us. Sissela Bach is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, Secrets on the Ethics of Concealment and Revelation, and A Strategy for Peace, Human Values and the Threat of War. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave and Exterminate Others, and Hidden Conversations, An Introduction to Communicative Psychoanalysis. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. Sissela Bach, let's bring you back in here. If, in fact, lying is commonplace, how do we build trust in relationships, in society, with our leaders, with our athletes?
Well, I would argue first that it's too easy to say lying is ubiquitous. We have, in this discussion, talked about various forms of self-deception, all kinds of sort of marginal states. And so I think it is easy, actually, for people to begin to think about drawing those distinctions and to think about themselves, the kind of person they would prefer to be. But here I just have to quote a wonderful statement by Bertrand Russell. This comes back to self-deception. Every man, wherever he goes, is encompassed by a cloud of comforting convictions which move with him like flies on a summer day. I would argue that that's probably true. That doesn't mean that we can't try to cut back and cut back and cut back. Of course, we will always have a certain amount of self-deception. I like the expression, I think, from Professor Smith, of misrepresenting ourselves to ourselves and misrepresenting our world to ourselves. But we can try to straighten that out a little bit and work at it. And here I see a big difference in research between, on the one hand, psychologists who tend to more or less dismiss some of the moral problems, not necessarily the psychologist speaking here, and on the other hand, philosophers who take much more seriously the idea of trying to be as honest as you can with yourself.
Is trust the basis of relationships, and is there a cost to these various forms of deception?
I do believe there is a great cost, and this again is something that people realize only when they've squandered trust. They have betrayed people, they have betrayed themselves, no longer can they be trusted, and so that indeed is something that they often recognize too late. But that's where I also want to bring in the two perspectives we have. On the one hand, there is the perspective we can completely understand of people who need to get along in the world, and they are going to often do so by lying, in part because they don't quite see the problems that they may get into, and they don't see in particular the damage it does to themselves and to the trust that they're held in. And you can see that in marriages, you can see it between parents and children, among friends. So that's one perspective. The other perspective is that of people who have been deceived and who know just what's meant by this idea of no longer trusting a person. So my suggestion in my book, Lying, was, and I still agree with that, we really need to share both of the perspectives. We need to think, if we can, before we slip into an entire practice of lying, think of the perspective of those other people and what they will feel and whether they will trust us again.
I'd like to bring Charles Ford back in for a moment. What about this idea of cognitive dissonance? Does that come in when we deal with these various kinds of lies or deception?
At times when people lie, there really is that type of internal conflict where they are trying to hold two disparate facts or two disparate ideas in their mind at the same time. My perspective on lying and the way that I became interested in this is probably somewhat different from the two other guests on the show. And that is, I became fascinated with the phenomenon of pathological lying, of people who lied continuously, even when it didn't serve them any useful purpose. And so I worked backwards from that. I worked backwards from the very pathological to try to see what that would tell us about normal, quotes normal people. I'm not sure anybody's completely normal. And what I had found is that those people with pathological lying are people that we might describe as having disorders of the self. That's kind of a technical term. Another way of describing it is saying they're very narcissistic people. And one of the characteristics of narcissistic people is that they have very little empathy towards others and often very little understanding of how others think and feel. And that's why I was trying to get to the idea that often these people don't have a great deal of conscience. They don't have a great deal of regret over what has occurred with lying because the world revolves around them anyway. Now, if all people had a sense of right and wrong that was internalized, and the primary value was their care about other people, then there would be a much greater level of trust and of honesty.
David Livingston Smith.
I think this is a slightly rosy picture. I mean, we're in the happy situation of primarily agreeing with one another, all three of us, but I do think this is a bit rosy. I think it would be actually quite nightmarish if people did not lie to one another on a regular and daily basis. Lying greases the wheels of social interaction. Now, I'm using lying in a very broad sense here. Some people want to confine lying to a very narrow, deliberate telling of untruth. I'm wanting to use it in a broader sense. You can call it deception, if you will. I think our lives depend on it. Our social lives depend on it, and our personal lives depend on a measure of self-deception. And as I mentioned before, there are situations in which lying is the morally right thing to do. Deception is the morally right thing to do. So I think we have to make a distinction between the sorts of deception that are necessary for us to find one another bearable, and indeed to trust one another to some degree, and the surplus deceptions. I think the surplus deceptions, that's what we find in cases like Bill Clinton and Lance Armstrong and so on, the unnecessary deceptions. And those are the ones we should really be especially concerned about.
Cicely Buck?
Step in here. The business of saying that we lie all the time, and I'm really in agreement with Professor Smith that that's a very, very broad definition. And it reminds me when my book Lying came out in 1978, Time magazine had an article which purported to have scholars saying that we lie hundreds of times. Everybody lies hundreds of times a day. Well, I wrote to Time and asked about those people and what are they talking about. Turned out that they were talking about such things as smiling to somebody that you see in the elevator, that all kinds of things to them seemed to be lying. And I think that it's extremely important as people think about deception and lying to try to sort out the different kinds, to notice that smiling is not lying, for instance. And that will help with coming to grips with this question of whether when lying might be acceptable. I would argue that that is very rare, but it can definitely happen when you're trying to save somebody's life, for instance.
I'd like to come back to that because I don't think it's obvious what a lie is and what a lie isn't. And we can give narrow definitions and broad definitions of it. I think there's some advantage to being rather liberal about what a lie is because we tend to self-servingly constrain lies to certain sorts of very deliberate misrepresentations. And that kind of lets us off the hook.
Charles Ford?
We have a very complex subject which we can look at from multiple angles, and I think that it is not that anyone is right or wrong. I think we are just merely looking at the subject from different perspectives.
The one thing we did not talk about that I wanted to get into, the psychobiological aspect of deception. David Livingston Smith, is this something that you would like to do?
Sure. I mean, amongst non-human organisms, deception is so common, it's virtually universal. organisms deceived by their behavioral routines, by their form, their morphology, by their coloration. It is really extraordinarily common. Even organisms without a nervous system, certain sorts of plants that deceive wasps and bees into pollinating them, it's very, very pervasive.
From the human neurobiological standpoint, we have learned a great deal over the last 15 years in terms of the functional neuroimaging of the brain. In other words, we can tell what parts of the brain are activated when a person tells the truth, and there's a difference when they are telling an untruth, and yet a different activation when they're withholding the truth. And basically what these findings are, without going into the details, are that it requires more brain activation to lie than it does to tell the truth.
I would wonder if that would be part of where the cognitive dissonance comes in.
Well, some people are very successful, however, in suppressing half of the conflict that would cause cognitive dissonance.
Well, let's leave it there then. Charles Ford, David Livingston Smith, and Cicela Bock, thank you, all three of you, for being with us.
Thank you very much, and thanks to my both.
Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Cicela Bock is a senior fellow at the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, formerly a professor of philosophy at Brandeis University. Among her books are the seminal Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life. David Livingston Smith is professor of philosophy at the University of New England. He is the author of several books, including Why We Lie, The Evolutionary Roots of Deception and the Unconscious Mind. Charles Ford also joins us. He is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neurobiology in the School of Medicine at the University of Alabama. His books include Lies, 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 The Psychology of Deceit. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian.